them. 14 hours. It would be more by the time they got to the cottage. I wondered if they would drive the way we used to, the M5 to Taunton, then across country to Chard, Axminster and Bridport, the final 3 miles to Burton Bradstock, with the sea between the hills on the right. The children used to be impatient by then, wanting to stretch their legs. "I'm sorry, Jenny," Michael said simply as he walked towards the table. "How are you going to find her?" My voice rose uncontrollably. "What about the rapist? Every second—"
"It's not the rapist," Michael interrupted. "He was picked up 10 days ago. He's in custody. We're doing all we can at the moment. We have taken prints from the dressing room, the theatre, the seats, and the changing rooms. Her friends are being interviewed."
He looked at me carefully, checking I was following.
"We are asking residents and the school about cars in the area at that time, and checking CCTV cameras in all the local garages and on roads going out of Bristol."
I watched him as he went through the list. His grey eyes were serious.
"We are also putting together a photo fit from Mrs. Mears' description, and it will go out on television on the 6 o'clock news this evening. We are taking this very seriously."
It made it better, but it made it worse. I was sliding down somewhere I had never been before, hands out, trying to hold on. He stood by the kettle, found the jar, then milk, made 2 cups of coffee. He gave me one of them and sat down again, facing me across the kitchen table, which was still littered with packets of cereal and the carton of juice, dirty bowls and mugs of cold tea.
"We are making some assumptions here," he said. "We have to look at other possibilities, however unlikely."
"Other possibilities?"
"There are several. First, there are good possibilities."
I looked up quickly. "How do you mean, good?"
"She is with a friend. She's sleeping, or she has simply taken time out."
"Naomi would never do that. Besides, she had one more performance to do."
"Perhaps the pressure?"
"No." I shook my head. I wished I could believe that. But however she might have changed, whatever we had missed, I knew she wouldn't have just left the play like that.
"Then there are other options. She met the unknown man for a brief while, or maybe not at all."
He was telling me she could have been abducted from the theatre by someone completely different, or on the way home perhaps randomly by some brutal stranger. I stared at him in silence. Which would be worse? Someone who had befriended her, planning to do her harm? Or a stranger hiding in the shadows outside the theatre door, or further away down the street? I stood up, but my legs felt too weak, and I sat down again.
"Does anything else unusual cross your mind? Something you may not have noticed or have got used to? Enemies?"
He passed me a notebook and a pencil. Holding the pencil in my hand steadied me. I looked at him. He knew how to help, but the downturned edges of his sad mouth told me he didn't like this part of his job. "You're used to this," I said. "You know what to do." It sounded like an accusation. I could see he was considering his reply carefully.
"Yes, but every time it's different. Like your job. You must see lots of people with the same sort of illness, but no one is ever the same. There is no set routine."
He was right, of course. I nodded, and he opened his own notebook.
"Who lives next door?"
"Flats. People come and go. Mostly young couples. We don't know them, really."
"Opposite?"
"Mrs. Moore and her son. He has Down syndrome."
Michael wrote that down as well. "Anyone else at all?"
"Enemies," he had said. I thought of Anya's husband scowling at me when he dropped Anya off. Mr. Price's eyes last time I had seen him. Friends were easier. Nikita. She had lots of other friends at school, but the only other one I could think of now was the boy who had helped her with maths, James. The one she said she had gone to the cottage with. The one who had given her the ring. I began to write my list slowly. It took a long time to marshal my thoughts. When the phone rang, I started up, heart thumping, but Michael moved swiftly to answer it.
"No comment," he said tersely after a small pause, then repeated, No comment. As he hung up, he turned to me. The media will be intrusive. He had dealt with this before as well. I'll prepare a statement for you now, asking them to respect your privacy. I stared at him. All I cared about was Naomi, seeing, hearing, touching, holding her. Privacy seemed completely irrelevant. I finished the list and gave it to him, and he stood up to go. I didn't want him to. It felt less desperate with him there. He said he would be back in 2 to 3 hours. After he left, I sat still for a long time, incoherent thoughts racing through my mind. Eventually I stood stiffly, glancing at the clock. 16 hours now since we had expected her back, 22 since she had walked out of the door. Just then, I remembered her voice as she said goodbye. But strangely, I couldn't remember if I had said goodbye to her. 14. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later. I lay green wash on the paper, then mix sap green and crimson for a greyish green, but the colour is too cool. It needs to glow, darker, thicker. I layer on viridian green and raw umber. The purple and deep brown of the sea lifts up to the edge of the sky as if it would swallow it. I stipple white spume along the crest of a wave, but mostly I want the dark, heaving shapes of water. Even as the painting takes shape, I feel the rope it is offering me. I imagine it is rough with salt and wet under my hands. I stop from time to time to put wood on the fire, swallow wine, a sandwich, pacing as I eat. Sometime after midnight, the picture lets me go. The fire is flickering low, and the room feels warm and safe, though outside the storm is still raging. Last year, our lives were destroyed in a raging, pitiless storm. I'd clung on then because I thought we would find her and because of the boys. Theo and Ed kept me going. Bristol, 2009. 1 day after. Theo came home from school in the late afternoon. He had bought fish and chips in a white paper bag, translucent with grease, and the smell of vinegar made me feel sick again. When the phone call came, I used the noisier as an excuse to go upstairs so that Theo wouldn't hear the conversation. Ted's voice sounded strained. The cottage is empty. No one's here. No one's been here in the last 24 hours. So she hadn't been taken there. I waited. She was here, though, last week, like she said. Only... Yes? She... They... What? My head was tingling with impatience. The bed's been slept in. There's a stain. Through to the mattress.
Slept in? But she didn't stay the night.
Then his other words caught up with me.
What do you mean, stain?
I asked, my voice trembling. What sort of stain? Blood.
Jesus.
I couldn't speak for a second. They say it's several days old, and it's smeared on the floor as well. He was speaking quietly. Someone must have been near, perhaps listening to what he was saying. You can tell how old it is by the colour. That's what this officer says. He's in forensics, and the wine in the glasses has dried. Definitely there for longer than a day and a night.
Wine? What wine?
I didn't know what he meant. There's a bottle next to the bed. 2 glasses.
Glasses of wine next to the bed? She never drank alcohol. She had smelt of wine after the rehearsal and at the dinner after the first performance, but I thought that was probably because everyone was drinking. I thought she hated alcohol.
It must have been the friends she went with. Some of the kids she knows are much more grown up. Even as I said it, I thought of the little girls who came to the practice, pregnant at 12. But Naomi wasn't like that. She'd never had a boyfriend. I told that to the police. It wasn't possible she'd been in bed with someone. She didn't go with friends. Ted's voice came back harshly. That was another lie. There were only 2 sets of footprints. It was just her and that bastard. You thought she was preoccupied when she came back the other day? Hardly surprising. She was traumatized. There was a rasping intake of breath. He got her drunk first. Even as I shrank from the words, I tried to think beyond them. If that's true, that's all right, I heard myself saying. Drinking together, that's a good sign. What? Good she was drunk when he raped her? I flinched at his cold incredulity. No. She had been standing so quietly inside the door. We saw her when she came back after the cottage. I would have known if something bad had happened. She was so calm. I spoke more quickly, feeling more certain. Think about it for a moment. If you have wine with someone in bed, it means you're relaxed and talking. Enjoying, Ted cut in. A local team arrived about an hour ago. They're taking samples, fingerprints, photos, DNA. I kept the wine glasses in my mind. He would have poured her a glass, put his arm round her. She would have sipped it, smiling at him, pretending she liked it. The wine means he liked her. I spoke carefully. The blood is because it was her first time. So if she is with the same person now, he won't hurt her. Not if they made love. The words sounded ridiculously out of place. But love was better than rape, better than murder. Wake up. Of course it must be the same person, but it doesn't make it any less dangerous. It will all be part of a plan. That was just the start. His voice shook. There was a silence, and then he told me they were getting another team down. There would be house-to-house questioning in the village. It was all going to take longer than he'd thought. I wished then we had known more people in the village, but we had never stayed long enough to make friends. We'd always been absorbed in family, making the most of Ted's time off with us. Now I wished I had reached out. I would have had someone to ask if they'd noticed anything different, or if there had been strangers lurking in the village. I went back to the kitchen. When the phone started ringing, I lifted the receiver. But as I heard the bright voice of a journalist rapidly introducing herself, I quickly cut the call. The phone rang again immediately, and I ignored it. Ed came in. He stood still when he saw me, and for a moment he looked frightened. I put my arms round him. His eyes were bloodshot. Had he been crying? He stayed quite still, his muscles tense. It's all right, Ed. It's going to be all right.
Nothing's all right.
He shrugged me off and walked away. When he sat down on the sofa, I sat next to him. He got up then and sat in the chair. I heard Theo open the fridge door. Whatever happened, I'm on your side, I said quietly.
What do you mean?
Michael Coppier from the police force came to see us. Apparently you told Mrs. Mears...
Oh, fuck.
You don't have to tell me now.
Oh, yeah?
They might need to check with you. Obviously, I want to know about Naomi.
See? You never mean what you say. Ever.
I waited, watching the anger burn in his face. He looked down.
I told Mrs. Mears I would walk Nick and Naomi home. While I was in the loo, Shan turned up and took Nick.
Yes, I know she did.
After that, while Naomi was changing, she yelled through the door for me to go. She told me a friend was coming to walk her home. She made me go.
I knelt in front of him, held his arms. It's not your fault, Ed. Or it's everyone's, mine and Dad's as well. Naomi always makes people do what she wants. As I said it, I knew it was true, and it gave me hope. It meant she could make whoever had taken her let her go. Ed turned his face away. Theo leant against the wall wearily.
Mrs. Mears resigned, he said.
I stood up and turned towards him.
Why?
Behind me, Ed got up and walked out.
A member of staff is supposed to be in the theatre with the kids at all times. She must feel awful.
Theo's voice trailed away. I felt sick again. So Mrs. Mears knew that if she had acted differently, Naomi might still be here. But whatever guilt this teacher felt couldn't compare to the terror Naomi might be going through, the agony we were enduring. Blazing anger surged inside. but I knew it wouldn't help, because then I would have to feel angry with Ed as well, and the useless rage would swell and block out everything else. I had to stay sane.
No one's saying anything to me. Theo sounded puzzled. No one wants to talk to me at all. It's weird.
I tried to explain. They think they should say something, but they don't know how to. So it makes them feel awkward. It doesn't mean they don't care. Perhaps you'll have to take the first step.
I tried, but two guys just walked away. It's as though I've got some disease they're frightened of catching.
I hugged him quickly. It was better to hold him than to talk. I didn't have the words to make it better. I couldn't tell him what they had found in the cottage yet. How could I worry him when it didn't make sense? At 6, we watched the news. Even though I watched and listened, I took in only fragments.
Naomi Malcolm, most recently seen following her performance in a school play last night. The police are looking for a dark-haired man in his 20s or early 30s to eliminate him from their inquiries.
Then her picture, another school one I hadn't seen. She looked even younger. Her smile was wide, not the new half-smile. Her eyes were open and trusting. They wouldn't be trusting now. I switched off the television. To everyone else in the world, she was somebody else's child. There was nothing much in the cupboard, but no one was hungry anyway. I made Ed a sandwich, which he ate in silence. After the boys had gone upstairs, I walked round and round the kitchen, winding myself tighter and tighter, until I felt about to snap, like a weighted fishing line that has been reeled in to breaking point.
Help me, help me,
I whispered over and over again, clenching and unclenching my hands, sweating, drenched in despair. I was still in the kitchen when Ted came back much later. He went straight to the drinks cupboard and found an old bottle of whiskey at the back. He drank quickly, tipping the glass rapidly upwards.
They got the stuff they needed. They're analysing it. He must be stupid. He left fingerprints all over the place. You could see them on the wine bottle.
He drank again, put the glass down and looked at me for the first time. His eyes were narrowed.
We'll get him. He could have gone anywhere with her, but we'll be able to get him now.
What about the blood?
There wasn't much. It was smears, mostly.
Not much blood. She hadn't been hurt. I would have known. Just a week ago, her silence had been intense. She had been guarding a secret, not an injury. What had she been thinking about? Her lips had been moving. Had she been saying his name? Ted's voice was angry.
I've been thinking about who would do this. Someone normally powerless, showing the world that he could take what he wanted. Sex with a little girl in her parents' territory. She might have been flattered, not realizing that all the time he's saying to himself, this is easy, the first part of the plan.
Slow down. I took his hand. It was trembling like mine. What plan?
Don't they call it grooming?
He'd obviously worked it all out. He was whispering now. His breath came in little gasps. Sleeping with her in the cottage was the first part of it. He must have done that to gain power over her, so she would go out with him after the play, unsuspecting. Ted must have thought this all through on the long journey home. Now his words tumbled out as if he couldn't contain them any more.
By the time she realised it was a mistake, it would be too late. He would have taken her miles away. She could be a prisoner anywhere. He's free to hurt her however he wants. Rape her. Kill her.
At least Ted's voice was quiet as he said those words. I walked to the bottom of the stairs and listened. It was quiet. The boys were asleep. I thought of how the empty cottage must have smelt. Perhaps the curtains had been drawn, so the mess in the room was suddenly revealed when Ted had pulled them back. There might have been flies buzzing at the windowsills or dead in the dregs at the bottom of a glass. The journey back would have seemed endless. It would have been difficult to wait in the queue by the suspension bridge over the Avon. His eyes looked tortured. I put my arms round him.
Perhaps it was different, I whispered.
Perhaps it wasn't like that at all. What if he loves her? If he loves her, he won't hurt her.
Ted didn't reply, and the hopeful words disappeared into the silence as completely as if I had never spoken them. 15. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later. The wind gets up again later. I wake suddenly as the window rattles, catching as I do the edge of a dream. Harsh knocking. The sound of water. I'm dreaming the memory of another dream. Then a blast, shocking the night. Shaking everything, it has the quality of splintering. I listen, frozen still. Something has been broken out there. Despite the noise and my fear, I float and drift on the surface of sleep, aware that my hands are open and moving on the sheet, searching. There is a difference to the morning, the absence of sound, the unusually brilliant light. I look through the window, and the garden has disappeared. Unseasonably bright sunshine lies over wreckage. There are shards of bark and broken pieces of tree trunk everywhere. The apple tree has gone, carved up and scattered by the storm. Large wooden splinters have fallen on the garden walls and blackcurrant bushes. The gate has been crushed. There is an old saw in the garage, oiled and still sharp, immaculate as my father kept all his things. It hangs on a nail next to the chopping axe. A robin is pecking around the torn disc of turf at the base of the tree, whose rough, twisted roots now point towards the sky. Bertie noses the glistening boughs of wood, cocks his leg by the wall, and settles by the broken gate. Sawing into the great sections of trunk, I throw off the coat and then my jersey. My hand slips with sweat as I work the saw back and forth. The peaty smell of the fresh, wet wood reminds me of bonfires before they're lit, and of hiding in the bushes as a child before bed. The dark, curved branches of the crown stir another memory which I can't quite reach. I work on through the changing light of the morning. At my feet is the little hopping, whirring bird, looking and pecking. At midday I drink water and keep going until my fingers can't bend around the handle anymore and the skin on the palms is bleeding. I kick off my mud-clogged boots outside the open back door and walk into the cottage. The rooms feel washed with fresh air after the storm. A smudge of yellow shows through the glass of the front door. There is a small bunch of yellow chrysanthemums on the step, with four eggs in a plastic ice cream container. Mary must have left them. As I put the flowers in a milk bottle, my hands are so tired they tremble. I hold one of the eggs. The very shape feels kind. I can't remember when I last ate an egg. A year ago? It is freckled. There is a tiny soft feather stuck to its smoothness, a faint brushstroke of mud. I boil it quickly and eat it, then boil another, then another. I have no butter and no egg cups, so I peel them and fold them into slices of bread, into which I have pushed a knife full of Marmite stiffened with age. I found the pot at the back of the cupboard. I scrape the eggshell and breadcrumbs into the bin, a sudden burning image, as I do, of Naomi's freckled baby face at 2, of Marmite soldiers. Mary is better, or she wouldn't have been able to leave presents here. I walk out quickly before I can change my mind. Her cottage door is open, and voices come from inside. I back away, but Mary has heard me.
"Don't go running away," she calls.
There are bunches of bright flowers in cellophane wrappers on the table, heaped packets of cake. Villagers have heard she wasn't well. Mary is sitting by the table in an apron. Her cheeks are pink-brown, unlike the papery white of yesterday. A bird-thin man stands in the middle of the room, eating cake and dropping crumbs. A dark-haired boy is smoking a roll-up at the table, texting rapidly with both thumbs. He is introduced as Mary's grandson, Dan. He nods at me, looking up with eyes half shut against the smoke. The birdman steps forward, eagerly offering his hand.
"Derek Woolley, neighbour.
Retired solicitor and chief bell ringer. He laughs self-consciously.
Jenny. His handshake is flabby. His eyes on mine move quickly from side to side, as if to catch escaping secrets. I know his questions will be intrusive. I am tired of the ugliness of curiosity.
So, Jenny, how long have you been here? Of course, I've seen you and the family in the past, weekending, as it were.
I don't remember this man from back then. Since I've been here, I've turned my head when anyone passes me in the street. A few months, I tell him, glancing at the door. How soon can I escape?
Jenny was the one who helped me yesterday, Derek. She picked me up.
Mary speaks quickly into the silence.
Aha! So you're our good Samaritan. I've always wanted to ask. That's the bell. They've started already. You'll need to hurry now.
Mary holds the door open. Perhaps you could tell them I'll be along for Monday's practice instead. I'll be better by then. Derek Woolley shrugs, empties his cup, and picks up another piece of cake as he leaves, nodding briefly at me.
Sit down, dear, Mary says to me, shutting the door behind him.
Dan, on the way home from sixth form college in Bridport, has come by to help in her garden. Mary asks me if I want help too. She heard the tree fall last night. When I get up to go, Dan, still texting, holds the door open for me. Something in his face, unformed and restless, reminds me of Ed. Back in my cottage, the play of light and shadow is different. Looking outside again, I notice that the curving bars of the crown of branches make a pattern. Then I see that, for a second, Naomi's face has slipped amongst them. Of course, that's what the curved and fallen branches reminded me of. Naomi, within twigs, her naked body. Theo's pictures. Bristol, 2009. 2 days after. Michael Coppier and two colleagues stand in the kitchen early on Saturday the 21st of November. Ted was sitting down, still tired from his trip to the cottage the day before. His skin was pale and his eyes bloodshot. Neither of us had slept more than an hour. I had made breakfast, cleared up, brushed my hair. My mind was empty, which was good. I needed an empty slate on which to write a plan, uncontaminated by fear. There was a drill for medical emergencies, simple letters to remember. Don't waste time on emotion, we had been told as students, just follow the drill. A for airways, B for breathing, C for circulation. Think, don't feel. I reached for the cups and made tea. Think in a list. Michael watched us closely. He spoke slowly. He might have thought we wouldn't understand. They were following all the clues in the cottage and collecting information from neighbours. The old lady opposite thought there might have been a car parked outside the cottage for a while, though she wasn't sure. No one so far had seen Naomi or anyone else. DNA samples from the sheets and towels and CCTV evidence from local garages had been collected. Michael was here today because they needed to go through Naomi's room, then all the rooms in the house again. He wanted to speak to Theo and Ed separately, at the station, in the presence of a support worker. This part was routine. He introduced two colleagues, Ian, a heavy man in his mid-30s, and Pete, a young Jamaican. They would be helping with the search, which could take all day. Ted said he had to go to the hospital. There was a little silence after his words. They sounded normal to me, he had said them so often. But Michael nodded respectfully. Pete looked impressed. I followed him outside, shutting the door behind us. Do you have to go now? He looked down at me, but his mind was already at the hospital. I realized this would be his way of coping. Of course I do, he replied. I'm on call. Christ, Ted! Hand it on! My grip tightened on the door handle. His gaze didn't flicker. If I go now, it will only take an hour. I don't want to use up too many favours of my colleagues at this stage. I understood what he meant, but I had always understood.
It didn't make it right. I woke Theo and Ed and explained what was happening. Ed turned back into sleep. Theo was awake quickly and sat up, worry crumpling his forehead. I took Michael to Naomi's room. I had left it untouched as he had asked me to, but I wouldn't have tidied anything anyway. I couldn't bear to change how she had left it. Now, seeing it through Michael's eyes, I wanted to hide the clutter of unfamiliar underwear and clear away the scattered makeup. I could feel his eyes taking it in, red lipstick protruding in a domed stalk, lying on its side in the small pool of foundation, the lacy bras, the thong, the unmade bed. But that wasn't the real Naomi. Naomi was here, I wanted to say, in the cello against the wall, the photos of Christmas and Corfu in the shell frames that she made, in the friendship bracelets in the bowl, the dried autumn leaves behind her mirror. She loves autumn, I wanted to tell him. She collects leaves, like a child does. She is just a child. That bra must belong to a friend, the thong as well. They can't be hers. I've never seen them before. But then, I hadn't seen the shoes before either, the high-heeled ones with straps. There was that smell of alcohol and cigarettes, the way she had turned away when I spoke to her. What had I missed? What clues did I need to understand before it was too late? Michael reached up and was looking through her books, glancing at me. I nodded. He picked out every book and shook the pages. On the second shelf down, a third of the way along, he pulled out a slim volume which I hadn't noticed. The shiny cover was patterned with flowers. Inside, as he flicked the pages, I could see her rounded handwriting. It looked like a diary. I wanted to snatch it back. Naomi's thoughts, if that was what was written there, didn't belong to Michael. They were hers, mine to look after for her. I put out my hand.
I need to go through this, he said quietly.
So do I.
I'm sorry, but...
Please, can I have it?
My hand was stretched out, the fingers trembling. I know how you feel, he said.
No, you don't.
Don't say that, I continued silently. You've never lost a child of your own. I looked at him. Perhaps he hadn't had a child. He had the unscathed look of a childless man. You're right. He sounded contrite. Of course, I don't know exactly what you are feeling, but there could be vital clues in here.
Perhaps Naomi's things didn't belong to her anymore. Perhaps it was right to let strangers plunder her secrets, if it helped to find her. In her absence, she had forfeited her right to privacy. Think, don't feel. A, B, C.
Look through it first, by all means. He handed the little book to me, but I will need to take it away afterwards. It's evidence. I'm sorry.
Did he think I would alter things or tear out pages? Would I have done?
I sat on the bed to read Naomi's words. I flicked through the pages. Her writing was smaller and tighter than I remembered. My eyes skimmed the lines. The first entry was dated nearly 2 years ago, January 2008, something about Christmas presents. I opened it at another place, August 2009, 3 months ago. I saw the words Dad and Hospital. I turned to the last page for a name, a place, anything to go on. The last words, Cottage Tomorrow, J, 10 weeks. She must have written this just a week ago. J? 10 weeks until what? Back a page. A scatter of pencilled hearts overlying three letters. X, Y, Z. The X and Z had been written in black, the middle letter in red, a little heart just touching the forked top. No names anywhere. No dates.
Hockey first away. Skied science. Bring roll-ups.
Naomi skiving science? She loved science. Smoking? I put the diary down for a second, feeling giddy. These notes could have been written by a stranger. I looked rapidly around the room, my glance stopping at the little mirror. She had looked at her face in the glass just 2 days ago.
Who was she becoming as she put on her makeup? Further back.
Theo got commendation, thanks to me.
His photos of her in the tree. That bit made sense.
X, Y, Z, after school. Tell N.
Those letters again. After school. The play? Words or scenes to learn for the play, maybe. N for Nikita. Nikita had been so silent, so awkward when we saw her that night. What else did she know? Michael was looking in the wardrobe now, pushing the hanging clothes apart and picking up her shoes, turning them over. He went across to the chest of drawers, opened them one by one, felt under the clothes. I had to be quick. I jumped further back in the diary, seeing just a list of dates and times, which started back in August, the school holidays. The same initials, and a new one, K.
X, Y, Z. K, nearly finished.
If it was in August, it can't have been the play. She'd done some coursework in the holidays. Was that what she meant? Michael sat beside me on the bed. I can't find anything I understand, though N could stand for Nikita, I told him. The only thing that's clear is she was smoking and missed science. Michael looked at me, then away. He was sorry for me, but didn't want to show it. I pointed to the page. There are groups of letters that keep reappearing. X, Y, Z. Some sort of a code? Letters at the end of the alphabet might have a special significance.
K, nearly finished. Schoolwork nearly finished.
Michael looked carefully at the words.
Initials of friends or a place?
I shook my head. I didn't know. He took the book gently from me and put it in a plastic folder.
I'll photocopy this and give it back to you. In the meantime, see if you can think of anything.
At that moment, there was a knock at the door. Ian came in. He looked excited.
Something you should see,
he said breathlessly. We followed him downstairs. Ian had found Theo's photos of Naomi's naked body hidden within branches. Michael looked at them, frowning slightly. At that moment, Theo walked out of the bathroom. His face wet from the shower and disarmed by sleep, darkened with incredulity as he realized his pictures had pushed him into the nightmare. He explained the theme of his project and how Naomi had wanted to take part. Ian, eyes narrowed, asked Theo to repeat what he'd just said. I could tell he didn't believe him.
You can ask Nikita, I said quickly, moving closer to Theo. She was there, she'll tell you.
Michael went to phone Shan. He arranged for us all to meet at the police station. He said it was a useful place to get some questions out of the way. All I felt was burning impatience that this would hold up the search. In my head was a moving image of a car with Naomi inside, her face pressed against a window driving past me. I could have stopped it at the moment it passed me, but it had moved further, so I was just too late. No, if I ran, I could still stop it. But that moment passed too. It became endlessly just too late, too late, too late. The desperate feeling replayed itself in a loop as I drove to the station, and the little car in my head that was taking Naomi away drove further and further into the distance until it became a speck and vanished. In the police station, Shan and I sat side by side outside the rooms where the children were being separately questioned, in the obligatory presence of a voluntary support worker. Shan stared straight ahead at the closed door, and her voice was quiet.
I know you're going through hell, Jenny, but don't drag Nikita in. She's already told you everything she knows.
I'm not dragging her in. I was breathless with surprise, with anger. It's a police investigation.
Shan didn't reply.
Naomi had a diary.
My voice was trembling.
Nikita's initial is in there. Naomi might have told her something secret, and Nick is frightened to tell us in case...
What secrets?
Shan's voice was harder now.
Naomi hasn't been round much lately. They haven't got secrets. They're not little kids.
You can't know that for certain. I know my daughter, Jen. Leave her. She's upset enough.
I know my daughter. The words seemed to echo along the narrow corridor with its green shining floor,
hitting against the high walls that were marked with black scuff marks. At the far end, I could see a policewoman at the desk, her expression calmly severe. She probably told herself she had to be professional, which in her world meant tough. After a long time, one of the doors opened. Nikita came out, followed by Michael. She looked upset and went quickly over to Shan, who put her arm round her. Nikita rested her head on her mother's shoulder while I looked away. Michael opened the adjacent doors, and the boys came out. Theo squatted down, hands hanging between his knees. Ed leant against the wall, his eyes closed. He looked exhausted. "Thanks." Michael included us all in his gaze. "Great help. Sorry to have to drag you all here. No one's in any trouble. I understand about the photos now, and I apologize for having to ask all these questions." He looked at me. "Sorry," he said. I took the boys home. They were silent. There was nothing to say. 16. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later. The unseasonable November weather holds after the storm. A late Indian summer scented with bonfires, the smoke twisting through sunlit branches still hung with the last shriveled leaves. Smashed tiles lie in the road. A window frame rests on glinting shards of glass. The man who owns the shop bends awkwardly over his paunch, his stocky legs spread wide to pick up scattered milk crates and an overturned metal bin. Wisps of ginger hair fall forward. He wipes them carefully back into place with thick fingers, all the while talking with relish of the storm's wreckage in the village. Then he says, "Mary told me young Dan will be cutting up what's left of your apple tree today. I'll take whatever you don't need, cash." I go inside the shop and turn towards the shelves, feeling breathless. Is this what happens when you step outside your space? People start to close in around you. I should have known. I put apples in my basket, coffee, and a little pot of Marmite. My hands are stiff from yesterday's sawing, and I almost drop the jar of coffee. Dan will stumble awkwardly into my quietness. I'll have to get something for him to eat. Biscuits, baked beans, not enough. There are frozen hamburgers in the small freezer. I reach for milk, juice, beer. A small bag of onions lies in a corner of a dusty cardboard box, and I take them too. I can manage this. He's just a boy. I remember that I'll need to pay him and ask for cash back at the till, turning my head from the man's curious stare. I hear the whine of a saw as I approach the cottage. Over the low wall I can see into my garden, where Dan's bent back and thin arms are weighted with the machine in his hands, chunks of wood already piled around his feet. Bertie pulls free of his lead and bounds up to him as soon as I open the garden gate. I freeze, thinking Dan might drop the machine in fright or spin round hurting himself, but I needn't have worried. He straightens, turns it off, leans down to pat Bertie. He pulls off the scarf he had tied around his nose and mouth to keep out the wood dust. Close up, his face is flushed and sweaty. Dark hair sticks in clumped strands to his forehead. His eyes are uncertain, his smile lopsided. Again, I am reminded of Ed, who had that same shyness before it hardened into blankness. Dan ducks his head and glances away. I've been staring at him, looking for Ed. He gestures to where he has put the crown to one side near the wall. The larger branches, still attached, hold their claw-like shape.
"Can I take those?" he asks.
Theo's photos of Naomi hidden amongst branches. My face must have changed because Dan's voice falters in the silence.
"Only I make sculptures out of wood. I sort of use shapes that are there already. I like those."
Then he says,
"They're a bit like hands."
Hands made of curving wood. I made them kind hands, holding her carefully. "Course, Dan. Sorry. Help yourself." I pull myself together and smile at him. Theo's photos fade, and I go back to enter by the front door in case the posters arrived.
There are three cards on the mat. My heart lifts. One is a sepia picture of Bristol docks as they used to be. Anya's tidy writing on the back. It's her third card to me.
All is fine, Anya.
She stayed as she promised, even after I left, and for a second I see her picking up Ted's scattered socks, washing the hardened food from his nighttime plates, gently wiping the dust from the photos next to our bed. I usually send her a card of the beach in reply, though there is nothing much to tell her except that I miss her. There is another card from Ted, a river scene this time. As usual, he hasn't written anything. He may not even be in Bristol. He probably goes to more conferences now that there is nothing to keep him at home. A thick blue stripe and white spray. Hockney. It's from Theo. And for a second, I think my memories have surely conjured this up.
In California for a weekend, making a splash. My pictures in SF City Gallery. Trip paid for by year prize. Wood Nature Series. Coming home for Christmas. With Sam? Kiss. Theo.
Christmas with Theo. The past 4 months in New York must have flashed by for him, full of new experiences the scholarship has brought him. But I long to see him. The fair eyebrows, the sheer length of him, the smattering of freckles, his laugh. How suddenly, briefly, he will still put his head on my shoulder, as he did when he was little. The way he lingers late in the kitchen, leaning his frame against the wall, eating cereal, wanting to talk. His fierce occasional hugs. I don't yet know much about Sam, apart from the fact that he's an architecture PhD student. Theo sent me a photo once, his arm round this man. Long, studious face, heavy glasses, smiling. Something I hadn't seen coming. Or had I? Ed had never teased him about girls. It was always the other way round. I'd thought art was his main focus, and that was why he'd never had a girlfriend. I never went beyond that. I'd been blind to the subtext, unwilling to encompass complications. Blind to Naomi's secrets, too. Though hers had led to disaster, not love. I put the postcard down as that thought flares. Out of the window, I see Dan moving by the tree, and from here it looks easy. The wood falls as if effortlessly, the low screeching muted by glass. I close my eyes, and into my mind comes the image of the tree crashing over in the dark, changing the landscape of the garden forever. Ted might not be welcoming to Sam. I want to welcome him. Theo has found someone to love. He has so much love to give. At the same time, I'm frightened. Unknown territory. How will Ed feel? How do I feel? I run water into the kettle, sort out the shopping. I know that I mind that he will never have children. I mind that the world may make it hard for him. The man in the shop would whisper to his customers if he knew. In the tiny world of the village, they might be curious, gossiping. I make Dan a mug of tea and take it into the garden with the packet of biscuits. As I put them on the step for him, he sees, giving a thumbs-up sign. The garden feels warm, and, fetching my sketchbook, I try to catch the lines of the branches, their curves gleaming in the bright November air, like dark arms swimming, cutting space instead of water. The sun shines brilliantly on the paper, highlighting sooty grains in the harsh lines of charcoal. All the while, the robin makes sudden flutters around the stumps of wood, pecking at the dust, flying to perch on the fallen branches. Walking around the twigs, searching for other angles, I sense Dan's presence lightly behind me. Lying down, the wet seeping into my jersey, I have the perspective I've been looking for. Lines curving upwards and away above me, coming together at their tips, enclosing a globe of air. Complete. When the church bells from the clock tower ring out twice, I go inside to cook the hamburgers. As they fry in the pan, the unfamiliar rich smell makes my mouth water. I've been living off apples, toast, and coffee for as long as I can remember. Suddenly craving meat, I cook them all, stirring in a hastily sliced onion, then pile them together between slices of bread and take them outside with two cans of beer. We sit together on the stone step of the back door in the sun. Dan devours one hot sandwich after the other. I eat more slowly, enjoying the taste of the food, the warm light on my face. The moment feels good. Thanks. Dan's smile is gap-toothed. I shake my head. Thank you. You've done lots here already. Yeah, well, gets me out. Out of what? Looking sideways at him, I sense he doesn't mind questions thrown out like this. School, home, other stuff. You like making things?
Yeah.
Wood? He nods.
I like finding shapes in the pieces, jigsawing them together.
The sleepy, unsure look has vanished. He is looking at the twigs, moving his hands, his voice louder than before.
You're lucky to know what you want to do, I tell him.
Yeah?
Lots of people don't. He looks at me.
My dad doesn't want me to make arty stuff for a living. Calls it a waste of space. Wants me to go into the police like him.
Will you?
Dunno. I suppose.
His eyes are clouded with struggle. I stand up and take the plates. Not easy, choosing.
Bloody right.
He gets up, slides the scarf back on his face. I come out again to finish the charcoal drawing, but it's colder already. The brightness is gone. The twigs look dull. It all changed in that brief time. Dan starts to gather up the logs into a pile against the wall. Bertie tracks him back and forth, sitting against his legs when he stops. Perhaps Dan reminds him of the boys. They have fallen out of his world completely. Dan stops for tea, hunkering down on his heels. Bertie pushes into him, and he falls back, surprised into a laugh. Later, we carry more logs together and stack them beneath the overhang of the garage. Dan says he will come back to split them. As he swings his rucksack up, he notices the smashed gate. He picks up the pieces of wood tenderly and lays them out carefully like bones. He looks at the gaping wall.
I could make a new one, using these bits and some new as well, if you want.
Could you? I take all the cash I had got earlier and put it in his hand. £100. I had felt reckless when I'd got it. Usually I hardly spend anything. The thick wad feels glamorous, unreal. So many sheets of paper. We both stare at it.
I don't want all that.
Well, so I can ask you back.
Okay.
I watch him go down the road, towards Mary's cottage, bending forwards with the effort of pushing the wheelbarrow we have filled with logs for her. He is at that time when the future has no shape. One day it will come close up against him, and in boredom or panic, maybe because something pulls at his sleeve, distracting him, he will make his choice. That night, I don't paint or draw anything in my sketchbook. I think about Dan's choice, which will lead him to everything else waiting in the future. The choices I made led me to Ted, to Naomi, to here. How could I have known? If I go back far enough, it didn't feel like I was choosing so much as taking. In my gap year, teaching in Africa, a child had walked past me on her way to the classroom. She was limping. When she showed me her foot, there had been an ulcer on the underside, as big as a clementine, packed with stones and grit. At the bottom, I saw pink strands of muscle. After that, it seemed obvious. I knew what I wanted. Back then, I was completely sure. When you're young, you think you know everything. When I look at Naomi's portrait, I see determination. I see certainty. Sometimes, especially late at night, I think about the terrible moment when that certainty must have deserted her, and she realized she'd made a mistake. 17. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later. Hello, darling.
Hi, Mum.
Ed's voice is faint. I strain to catch at how he is through the crackling sounds on the line. I sometimes wonder if people listen in.
How are you?
All right.
He lost his mobile a week ago, so I imagine him in a corridor, leaning against the wall by the phone. The white paint would be smudged with little black marks where fingertips have been pressed hard against the paint. He will be staring out through the plate glass window. People pass and look. He is tall and good-looking. People have always looked, but his face will be as guarded as his voice. The pale hand holding the phone is thinner than a year ago, when it was strong and brown from rowing. I noticed on my last visit that his nails were lined with dirt.
Sorry, darling. I know I'm phoning ahead of schedule, but I couldn't wait. I've been thinking about Christmas.
Already?
A little flat word. Barely a question. I carry on quickly, my voice sounding irritatingly bright, even to me.
Well, it's already December. I know we didn't do Christmas last year, but I thought
that it's time for you to come home. You've been away too long, and I miss you.
You might want some home cooking.
They may want extra help. They're short-staffed.
That could be true. I can't tell. He volunteered to stay on at the end of his programme, helping in the kitchen in return for a bed. Mrs. Chibanda said giving back was part of the process. I was glad when she told me he could remain at the unit. What would he have done here, with me?
Dad's coming. He's going to Johannesburg for a meeting soon, but he'll be back by Christmas Day. I asked him to join us for lunch.
I pause, remembering Ted's few terse words on the phone last week.
He sent his love to you.
There is silence. He probably doesn't believe me. He never asks about Ted or the separation. I know he sees him sometimes, but he keeps it to himself.
What's been happening with you, darling?
I glance through the window while I wait for an answer. The sky is pale grey. Behind the church is a banked mass of darker clouds. A few seagulls wheeling high up flash white as they turn and fall. The garden has been swept bare of wood. Dan took all the branches. There is a ragged patch of bare soil where the tree used to be. Brown stumps of some forgotten vegetable and leafless blackcurrant bushes stand in the patch my father used to tend. The new gate is in place, with its two colours of wood, the old bars and raw new ones patched in. A sparrow balances on the top bar, and then, as a magpie swoops to take possession of the space, he flutters to the wall. Ed's words come quicker as he tells me he goes running with Jake now. I remembered the boy who let us into the centre and his sweet smile.
Jake's still there?
Thought I told you. We share a room. His sister brings in cakes and stuff.
That's great, Ed.
She plays the accordion and lives on this boat.
Friends. A girl. I won't ask questions, but my heart lifts.
Can I bring anything next week?
Pens. Maybe a notebook.
He pauses and then continues, speaking slowly.
I've been writing this diary. Dr. Hagen suggested it months ago. I've read a bit to Jake and Soph.
Be careful. Only tell those things you want to.
Well, obviously, but it has to be real. Naomi kept that diary, didn't she?
Jesus.
Yes.
I think it might have helped her. It helped you, didn't it?
After we say goodbye, I sit next to Bertie on the floor. He pushes his wet nose into my face, and I stroke his warm ears. I have no idea if it helped her to write that diary. They weren't really her thoughts. She kept those to herself. I suppose it helped us. It led us to James. I get up to take the sketchbook and pencil from the dresser and find myself studying the pictures as though they have been drawn by someone else, and there may be something there that will surprise me. The warm kitchen is home now, with a chipped formica table
faded brick floor, and the tiny noisy fridge in the corner. It feels safe. The Bristol kitchen had begun to feel alien by the third day. I was pacing round it when Michael phoned to tell me what he had learnt from rereading Naomi's diary. I can hear his words as I take the sketchbook to the windowsill and begin to sketch the magpie strutting on the gate. One for sorrow. Bristol, 2009. 4 days after.
So, I made a lucky guess that J might stand for her friend James.
What? Sorry, Michael. Could you say that all again, slowly? I was pressing the phone so tightly to my ear that it hurt. It was getting more difficult all the time. I saw everything through a shifting kaleidoscope of her. She would be smiling and laughing at first. Then the picture would change. Her mouth would open, screaming my name. I walked about the house, my hand pushing so hard over my own mouth I could taste blood. Nowhere in the familiar spaces felt like home. Ted and I had spent Sunday listening and waiting, watching the clock, pacing silently, praying for news. Hour after empty hour passed relentlessly by. No one seemed to be doing anything to find Naomi and bring her back. In intervals of exhausted calm, we had talked over what the boys should do. We all agreed it would be easier for them to cope if they had the normal structure of a day around them. I wanted to escape from the torture of waiting and go back to work, but Ted said I would be caught out if I did and break down. Frank agreed. When he came round in the evening, he told me he had found a locum for the duration. At least the boys slept. They went to school as usual. Ted had gone to work. He said he didn't have the choice. As I'd watched him from the upstairs window, I'd seen him straighten once he left the house and become his work self, his face changing as he thought of his day ahead. It would have been hard for people to have known that anything was wrong. He'd walked in his usual way to the car, his dark suit fitting smoothly over his shoulders, blonde hair brushed. I'd looked through the glass, knowing my hair hung in strands, my feet were bare, and my face was haggard. There'd been two white vans parked beyond Ted's car, with satellite dishes on top. Seeing two men leaning against the side of one, paper cups in hand, cameras strung round their necks, I had moved quickly out of sight. Michael's voice grew louder, bringing me back to the moment.
James was Jay, in Naomi's diary. I've interviewed him and Nikita again. I'm coming round.
I heard the phone click, and a few seconds later the doorbell rang. My sense of time had stretched or shrunk, and I wouldn't have been surprised to see Michael standing there, but it was a tall, flame-haired boy in school uniform. His tie was knotted low, his shirt was untucked, and there were the grainy tracks of tears on his freckled cheeks. His eyes were so swollen, it took a few moments to recognize him.
James!
Hi, Dr. Malcolm.
I stared at him for a moment.
She's not here, James. We haven't seen her since Thursday evening.
4 days. Even though I had suffered every minute of that time, the facts still struck afresh as I said them.
I know! Course I know! He looked angry. I've been at the police station since 4 this morning.
I took in his red eyes, the dark stains under them, and the faint stubble.
Why?
I couldn't sleep. I needed to tell someone. It's my fault!
His fault? What was his fault? What had he done? He read my face.
No, I... Look, I don't know where she is. I mean, I wish... I just wanted to see you. To explain.
He swayed on his feet, and I grabbed his arm and pulled him in. He half sat, half collapsed on a chair in the kitchen, and put his head in his hands. I made a cup of sweet tea and put it in front of him. The bell rang again, Michael this time. He looked serious, but his mouth relaxed into a smile when he saw me. As I stood back to let him in, I realized I knew his smell already. A calm male scent of clean iron shirts and toothpaste. He felt close, but that was an illusion. He was in a completely different place from me. Normal life was running on for him like it was for everyone. I could see it and smell it, but I wasn't part of it anymore. The transparent skin of disaster separated me from his world. I couldn't touch that world. I couldn't even remember how it felt now. James looked up with surprise at Michael, who smiled and touched him briefly on the shoulder.
"James has come to tell me something," I said, sitting down so I didn't loom over him.
"Good. We talked a lot last night." Michael pulled out a chair and sat next to James. His movements were slow, and I realized he probably hadn't slept much either. The boy's face was very pale.
"I love her,"
James's words spilt out suddenly.
"She loves me. I think she does anyway. We've been together for months."
Together? They'd both been in the play. Is that what he meant? I glanced quickly at Michael. He said quietly, "They have been sleeping together for the last 6 months." The room felt cold. I should turn up the radiator. Ted's economies were ridiculous in November. It wasn't possible. I would have known if she'd been sleeping with this boy. Naomi would have told me. Even if she hadn't, I would have known. I was her mother. Perhaps James read my thoughts. He carried on.
"She was going to tell you. Well, she knew you'd find out, anyway."
How was it possible? Naomi was here, or at school. I knew what she was doing.
After school, at weekends.
He spoke almost in a whisper. I leant closer to catch his words. He went on quietly.
"She told you she was with Nikita, but we actually went home. My home."
"Did your parents know?" I remembered his